So, with that, anyone present in this room who is familiar with bodhicitta, please give rise to this so that when we study these teachings, we will recognize that they are dedicated and aimed toward the benefit and liberation of all beings. Okay.
Can we say for folks who don't know what bodhicitta is, at least sort of an idea of what it is?
In a word, bodhicitta is awakened mind, and that will be what we're studying. Because when we talk about lojong, we're talking about what's called, it literally means mind training. And what we're training our mind to do is to become awake. And we are, therefore, we are learning about and we are actually giving rise to bodhicitta. This is our practice. And we'll be studying that and learning the theory behind it, or the view, and then we'll be able to employ various contemplative techniques to basically give rise to bodhicitta in our meditation, in our daily life, and particularly in context of the dynamics of working with ourselves and each other and the world. So, this text, the Prajnaparamita Sutra, also known as the Heart Sutra, is basically a way of simply making a declaration about the nature of the absolute, which is beyond our grasp of mind, but at the same time, it's completely clear and sane, and it is totally open and giving, intelligent, and loving. So if anyone is interested in incorporating this text in their daily practice as a recitation, or even periodic practice, it's highly recommended. And particularly because just the recitation of it alone helps our mind learn how to become more pliant and work with what we cannot understand with our logical reasoning mind. Because reality is beyond that dimension. So this helps us learn to explore that, open ourselves up to it with some sense of trust, some sense of faith, which we can learn about and through our practice. So I highly recommend it. Okay, so we start with the word lojong. And I just thought I would mention it in a few different ways. We'll talk about the theory a little bit, and then we'll talk about a little bit about the history, because this is a developmental thing that occurred in time. It didn't just show up suddenly. We've been studying Hinayana and Mahayana for some time. So what lojong is really about is entering and engaging in the Mahayana practice.
I think there are some newer people, so just if you, then when you use terms like Hinayana, Mahayana.
We're going to.
Okay.
In fact, I would like to ask someone to volunteer, if they would be willing, who's present, to briefly summarize their understanding of what the Hinayana is. Can be in one or two sentences. Would anybody like to try? Susan, yeah.
I think it's primarily sort of the first step of trying to deal with yourself. Then I have the next one, Mahayana, is more including others.
Yes. And what is this dealing with self and then dealing with others? Is there a word that could help us understand what that means?
With your thinking, with your mind?
There's a path, clear, a vehicle.
Yes. Okay, well, just to make it simple, We're talking about liberation or fundamentally freeing ourselves up. Liberation is essential to understand because from the point of view of basic Buddhist teachings, we start with the understanding that we are basically have difficulties in this life and we're confused. It's not like we have it all figured out at all. So we have an understanding of something, you know, of this, of emptiness or of emptiness of self called egolessness. And in the Hinayana, the emphasis is on freeing up, basically being controlled by our passions and basically being tied by our projections. The ego of self, the notion, the mythology of ourselves as somebody existing. Does that make sense? Does that ring a bell with people who we've all been studying this for some time? But I mean, it's important just to have some kind of an overview, as as Elise said. I mean, it's just to, so we're all on the same page. And so then we have something that when we come into the Mahayana, the Hinayana literally means the narrow path. Even though the practitioners of this call themselves Theravadins, they don't call themselves Hinayanas. It's not meant to be denigrated, but it's focused primarily on the liberation of the individual. So then we have the Mahayana. And the Mahayana is distinguished by something called twofold egolessness. Does that sound familiar to anybody here? Would someone like to volunteer what that means to them? Don't worry, nobody will bite.
I always get these things confused. Let me see if I got this right. That the twofold is the absolute and the relative, or it could be the twofold is compassion and wisdom.
Actually, let's go back to the notion of liberation or the egolessness itself. So you're sort of there when you talk about relative and absolute. Mm-hmm. But when we talk about one-fold egolessness, we're talking about this focus on the Hinayana, which is basically egolessness of self. That as we go through our meditation practice and investigate actually where our thoughts and passions, all of our impulses come from, we can't find anything there. I mean, no one has found this. So this is this huge, fantastic discovery that's going on every day if we give it a chance on the meditation cushion, which is just to investigate where do we come from? Where did this notion of I come from? And we can't find it. We cannot find our mind, even though we acknowledge readily that what we experience is our mind, right? But when you actually look for it, we can't find it. There's nothing tangible about it, right? There's nothing that we can actually hold on to. So that's why when we say nobody exists is because we're tending to believe that there's some kind of solid entity that's going on and permanent. And as we investigate the nature of and experience of our mind, we can't find that. So that's why it's called egoless, because there's no permanent self. It doesn't mean we don't have reference points. We use them. But the fact is that we take that jump, that leap, and assume that that so-called reference point is permanent, unchanging, which is not. We all agreed on that? Okay. So twofold egolessness is not only recognizing or training in, and we continue to do this because this is part of our work on our path, spiritual path of working on ourselves. It's not only working on ourselves alone to free ourselves up and discover our own egolessness. It's also the second fold egolessness is called the egolessness of dharmas. What does that mean? Okay, dharmas mean things or what we perceive as the world. So, you know, even though you could say ostensibly or theoretically, okay, I don't exist or I'm free from that kind of stuff, but still there's this world out there that I got to cope with. The world goes on, you know, it's got its thing, it's got its machinations, it's just this eternal, you know, satanic mills that are cranking away and blah, blah, blah. But frankly, I mean, as we learn and as actually modern physics has helped us understand, that, you know, really, there is nothing there except a bunch of probabilities. I mean, and so what that means is that when we go further and further investigating into the finer points of the nature of things, we can't find anything substantial or anything that's permanent. So by the same token, these are everything we call the world are a bunch of labels. But those labels we make up or we agree on, we simply... So that's the second fold egoless. This is learning how to recognize these things are just a series of consensus, that we have this consensus reality we all agree about. But we think it's real, but we only because we agree. But it's not, but you know, if somebody comes from another planet, they don't have that consensus at all. Or even from another part of this world who could live in a completely different dimension, as we know. Are we right? Are we on it? Okay, good. So, that's very important. And this basically training our mind, in the Hinayana, we are taming our mind. We're learning how to actually get in control, and as Trungpa Rinpoche said, becoming adult human beings, where we're actually capable of taking responsibility for ourselves, owning up that we're responsible for our actions. This is not all everybody else's fault. You know, we actually can own that up, right? And, okay, so that's very important. And at the same time, in this egolessness of other, we begin to realize that we're all sharing this problem. These problems are not our own private little issues, but they are the world problem. And what starts to happen is, as we learn more and more and begin to open ourselves up more to the reality of what's here, is that we have a spontaneous response. And it'll be interesting because Trungpa Rinpoche talks about it first in terms of something manufactured. We manufacture, we make up bodhicitta or this compassion to start with, of necessity. We don't understand what it means yet. But as we learn and as we practice, it becomes completely natural. In fact, it's the thing that's already happening inside us that we are simply unaware of as a rule because we're so caught up with our own stuff and think, my problems are the only problems that matter and everybody else's, you know, we'll deal with that later after I handle all my issues because I haven't got time to deal with this, right? We're all together in this. This is really important. So, okay. This is the theory or the view. And it's been given to us by people who are realized. That's why it's not only an idea, but actually we are part of, as we willingly open ourselves up to, a lineage or a tradition that carries an understanding of this, of this kind of understanding and a willingness to take responsibility for ourselves. And then actually also realize we are part of what making this larger world happen and we can take responsibility and meaning being really responsive and relating to the world we're in compassionately. Because we realize when we take this veil of selfhood away, when we just drops away, we realize we're not separate from each other. We share common ground. So, we'll start with talking about the path, which we know has to do with self-awakening, as Trungpa Rinpoche calls it, through shamatha and vipassana practice. Is everyone here familiar with those terms, shamatha and vipassana? Okay. I'm sorry.
Peter.
Yeah, hi. Peter, okay. So, with shamatha, would somebody like to briefly explain to Peter what shamatha is?
So the means peaceful abiding, so it's sort of the kind of meditation where you are focusing on something or some aspect of things to try to sort of settle your mind down to bring some peacefulness and some calmness. So it's often what people think all meditation is.
Right. You're basically learning how to rest your mind, learning how to relax and actually allow your mind to simply settle in itself. That's tranquility. There's various words, but that's basically what it is. Then we have Vipassana, which has to do with what starts to happen after we've settled our mind, which is insights. And these insights are things that we have all the time, but in the context of meditation, they become much more meaningful rather than just fleeting thoughts. We've established a connection with ourselves fundamentally and settled, and we begin to investigate and understand how our mind works. And we begin to understand, if I can understand my mind, I will be able to have some way of understanding more around the world that I exist in with others. And so that's very critical. So then we have making a commitment as we go further with this process of learning how to sort of, we work on recognizing our conduct, how our conduct affects each other. And we learn how to basically work on ourselves around that conduct. And so we're going to go into that a little bit. But at the same time, as we get into this Mahayana approach, we realize that we're heading towards a commitment to what's called a bodhisattva path, which basically is a commitment to benefiting others. It also benefits yourself, but you're not putting yourself in front. You're putting yourself aside because you're beginning to realize if you're inseparable from, and your well-being is inseparable from everybody else's ultimately, then fundamentally the concern is other. So that's how Mahayana distinguishes itself from Hinayana, which is fundamentally focused on taking care of me. And now we realize others actually are more important than we are, since we don't really have any kind of ultimate nature as such. Is everybody following me on this? Okay, good. And basically what this is where we learn, these are the teachings of wisdom and compassion, which have come to us for at least, you know, about 2,500 years at this point. All right, so a little bit more about, just let me go to this Lojong mind training history. Lojong mind training and history, the meaning of Lojong is where we're learning how to refine and purify our motivations and attitudes. And we're learning how to learn and generate this bodhicitta through exploring and going forward into discovering twofold egolessness, which we've discussed. And in the Mahayana, there are actually various Lojong traditions. It's interesting, even though we have just been presenting one when we've been studying Pema Chodron primarily and Chogpa Rinpoche's, but I discovered there are numerous Lojong traditions that employ, because all the Lojong traditions employ they employ slogans. And for instance, they're in the Nyingma, Longchenpa has 77 slogans, which basically take us through a series of mind training from the very beginning of learning how to tame our minds and going through the training, and then ultimately into the Vajrayana dimensions. And to briefly understand the difference between these three, I won't go into it at length, but we are dealing primarily with passion as the fundamental poison of the Hinayana. How do we tame our passions? How do we tame our impulses? In the Mahayana, we're learning about aggression, learning how to tame aggression. And then the third poison, does anybody remember what that is? We have three. Which?
Ignorance.
Ignorance, yeah. That's the Vajrayana. We're working with ignorance, right? So it's an interesting way of just understanding where why this has a sense of progress or a sense of going somewhere. But you know, we got plenty of work with this aggression business. The world has plenty of work.
Yeah.
No problem.
I think the world.
Anyway, there's this guy who really. There was a person named Chakawa Yeshe Dorje who was responsible for writing these aphorisms, and we're going to be studying these aphorisms. He basically found he was in a monastic cell, and he found his partner in that cell had a little inscription on his bed saying, "Gain and victory to others, loss and blame to myself." And he got very turned on to this, and he wanted to find out who said that. And so he found out that the author was somebody named Langri Lingpa, or Langri Tongpa, and he went to look for him to find out if he could learn more. Well, Langri Lingpa had died, but he studied with his students for 12 years to get more information. And it turns out, Chikawa Yeshe Dorje, he found that using these slogans helped him realize the union of the bodhicittas of relative and absolute. So we do talk about, and we will explore, relative and absolute. Relative means, as we talk about consensus reality, about our little world and what's happening here, and how we're experiencing these various specifics. And then absolute is basically transcending or beyond the grasp of our minds, whereas the relative is definitely within the grasp of mind. We're working with stuff. You know, we got jobs and we got relationships, we have people, we have everything we're dealing with. That's relative. Absolute is fundamentally the dimension from which all of this is basically contained. He's most naturally and neatly represented by zero, because it's beyond concept, beyond our ability to mentally grasp what it is. On the other hand, it doesn't mean we can't connect with it through our practice at all. We're very able to. And this is the fundamental point of meditation. And this is the fundamental point of the path of egolessness, of both self and other. Because this is where we discover this fundamental nature in us all, and this is called Buddha nature. So what we're doing in our practice is connecting with and giving rise to Buddha nature in our experience, in our lives. So it's not just some great person who lived 2,500 years ago who sat under the Bodhi tree and got it, and everybody else is sitting around trying to pick up the pieces afterwards. It's actually something that's fundamentally essential to us, and it's our basic nature. So that's what we're working with. Okay. So, after this guy spent 12 years studying, he basically went into a leper colony. First he dealt with his brother, who was a huge problem. No, I mean, just total hopeless wreck, you know. And the guy was just a mess for himself and everybody else. And he found by teaching him these slogans and by... there's something called 7 points of mind training, which we'll be going through, that his brother was actually able to switch around and get out of this and actually, you know, snap out of it and become a decent human being. So that was a major thing. But he got more inspired because he had a leper come up and ask him for help. And he started teaching these slogans. And the leper, this particular leper, seemed to be relieved. So he ends up going to a leper colony and spending a lot of time curing the lepers. Because, you know, everybody else says, don't give me your time of day. I mean, I've got other things to do. I got to deal with all my problems. I can't listen to you talking about slogans, you know. So anyway, as the lepers were cured, more people came to him and found out and wanted to learn more about the teaching. So that's actually how it developed in terms of our experience. So the important thing there was that that what it's about is a series of slogans, and let's see if I can find all my different a series of 59 slogans, which are a sevenfold means to purify and process the mind and stabilize commitment to the Mahayana practice of Bodhisattva path. And as Trungpa Rinpoche says, all of our Dharma practice is about switching allegiance from ego to Buddha nature. Mm. Wonderfully put.
Repeat that. That's good. Say that again.
Yeah. That's what we're doing. From the very beginning, when we actually start meditating and we just simply let our breath, out-breath go and let go, and using our breath to let go, we're actually learning how to actually open up. And then we have this little gap, which sometimes we notice and sometimes we don't, but it's there. And basically, as that gap widens and we begin to experience more of it, even though we don't call it a gap, it's not taking up space. It's just basically a little kind of drop, you know, or a little droplet or a little flash. That's basically when our Buddha nature starts coming in.
But so, Emily, that sense about let ego go back to that
shifting
sentence.
Your allegiance. That
yeah, switching allegiance from ego to Buddha nature.
Okay,
that's
good.
Yeah,
that's an important sentence in this whole talk.
Yeah. Yes,
that's the key right there.
There you go. A good, an easy thing to remember, right?
Switching or
oh yeah, pinch myself.
There's a 60th.
There you go. So, all right, so these slogans are very pithy and very simple. And then there are commentaries, and which are discussed, you know, for each one. And there are various people making commentaries on them. and we'll be looking at Pema Chodron's discussion, which is wonderful. We also have, in the past, studied Tralek Rinpoche's practice of Lojong, which is another very distinct way of exploring these materials. And there are several other books. I will just mention their names in case somebody gets on a roll and doesn't want to stop reading about this stuff. There's Norman Fisher is a guy who's a Zen teacher, and he basically taught something called training in compassion, and he's basically bringing in Lojong slogans to Zen because Zen does not have that in their tradition. Jigo Khongtro Rinpoche has written a book called The Intelligent Heart, which discusses this. Ringu Tulku, who's a really remarkable teacher, also has a book called Mind Training, and then a new book by Anyen Rinpoche called Stop Biting Your Tail.
It's like a new slogan.
Yeah. So all those are easily available. You know, you can either order it to Amazon, or you can go to Shambhala, or Shambhala's will handle Snow Lion, so it's readily available, easily accessed.
Stop biting.
All right. So let's see.
So that, what I was trying to think of, Michael, is which of those books does a lot about talking about how to bring the slogans into your life? Like a lot of them, I have several that sort of just say, here's what this one means, here's what that one means. And I'm always like, and what would that look like?
Well, for me, and for, I believe, like if I can speak for Mr. Levin and Ms. Weidman, we found Trungpa Rinpoche's Training the Mind to be an excellent resource because it carries into the notion of how we apply these things to ourselves. Uh-huh. That's the important thing. I mean, if you if the shoe fits, wear it kind of thing. You know, it's like if you find that I can actually employ this in my experience. Now, it doesn't mean I'll be able to understand each 59 slogans at any given point automatically, because we're going to have, you know, some biggies. We got the absolute slogans, which are meant to be just sort of like resting in those places rather than having them figured out. We're not trying to figure out how to experience, you know, liberation of shunyata poisons by, or seeing them all as five kayas. I mean, these are more things. So there are absolute slogans which simply set the groundwork for going into the details. But we'll have time to study these together and find out how to apply. Yes?
I got the impression that Chogyam Trungpa's book about training the mind is contained within Volume 2 of the Profound
Treasury.
It is.
A matter of fact, I'll give another plug, which is the great book, The Profound Treasury.
It's in there.
The Ocean of Dharmas is basically, it's incorporated, but it also brings it up in the context in which it was given, which was a seminary. So you have a kind of a slightly larger context of understanding, and he does give a background I've also looked at other places for providing the talk I gave tonight, but that's a wonderful resource. I mean, I'm reading this book and I'm just going, I got just all these pithy statements one after the other that are so on and so to the point. Yes, Emily.
So some people in our group might have purchased that because when we did the Paramitas, that material, we didn't really have another source book, and we took it out of Volume 2 of The Profound Treasury. So just to say again, Volume 1 is the Hinayana path, Volume 2 is the Mahayana path, and Volume 3 is the Vajrayana path. And these are all teachings of Chogyam Trungpa Rinpoche. But I also want to mention, although it's not exactly Lojong, I found Ken MacLeod, The 37 Practices of a Bodhisattva, absolutely penetrating. And it's not exactly Lojong, but it still has that same approach, you know, in terms of, you know, like kind of turning everything around. So you really undercut the ego.
Yeah, in fact, interestingly, Ken MacLeod initially translated this because he translated Jamyang Kongtrul's teachings on these slogans, The Direct Path to Enlightenment. But then after he consulted with Trungpa Rinpoche, he retranslated it as The Great Path of Awakening. Yeah. That's how you'll find it. Now, you might find an old version of The Direct Path to Enlightenment. That would be his first translation.
We have a number of these versions in our library. We have a Buddhist library at our house, and people can borrow different things. We have the one by Jamyang Kongtrul, Direct Path of Awakening. So a couple of these books are actually available to borrow from us.
So just so you'll...
The name of them?
It's called 37 Practices of a Bodhisattva.
That's a great book. We also did a lot of this early in our teaching here, probably in Unit 4 or something. But then
I think I put it. I don't know if she put it in the website. Yeah,
it's 6 and 10. Is on
6 and
I thought so.
I think later. I put it in. But yeah. Well, so there's earlier talks.
When we go over, we see how much better we could have done.
how much
we missed the point.
Could we have the titles of all of these books and the authors put on the website?
Sure. Maybe? Yeah, if you just...
We can put them up. And the other thing to understand is if you read Gelugpa translations of what they call... Because they have this Lojong training also, but you have to understand Gelugpas have a different approach to... most other traditions, and I'll explain that. There are two basic kind of options in this kind of Lojong training. One is contemplative, which is what we do. We're studying these slogans, we're contemplating it, and we're learning how to meditate, and we're learning how to engage them. And then the Gelugpas also are much more doing what's called the Pandita approach, which is basically more intellectual or conceptual. And it's based on basically... more dialogue or debate. And so that's actually a very strict tradition in their case. And they view that as essential to understanding. And, you know, it's interesting because debate was also employed in these traditional monastics everywhere. But what we're employing, what we're engaging with is basically contemplative. Let's see.
And what you, pardon me for interrupting, what you mean by Gelugpa is it's another lineage.
We have, so.
Tibetan.
Yeah, right, okay. So just to give you a very brief idea, we'll all just go through this quickly. In Tibetan Buddhism, we have four major schools of Buddhism, and then we have one other school called Bön, which is the native religion of Tibet, which has evolved particularly side by side with Buddhism considerably from just being a shamanistic approach. And inside Buddhism we have Nyingma, which is the oldest lineage, which was founded in around the 8th, 9th century. Then we have in the 10th century we have this wave of new translations. And these are three schools called, they all come out of the Kadampa tradition, which was started by Atisha. Now, Atisha is considered the father of all of the Lojong trainings. And he was from India. He came in at around sometime in about 1050 or something like that. And he brought this famous tea boy who was supposed, because he'd heard the Tibetans were supposed to be really nice people. But the tea boy was really terrible and as a conscious irritant. And then when he got to Tibet, of course, the Tibetans say, well, he discovered he didn't need to bring the tea boy because everybody else is problematic there too, you know, really difficult.
Irritating people everywhere.
Utterly.
Believe it or not.
So
it's a joke that the Tibetans have been keeping up for 1,000 years.
So at that point, when we had this new translation series starting at around 1,000, between 1,000 and 1,200 or 1,300, you have three other schools emerging. One is the Kagyu, which we have been studying with who's founded by Marpa through Naropa, Marpa, Milarepa, and then Gampopa. And we've been studying this tradition. This is a Kagyu tradition. There is the Sakya tradition, which developed simultaneously, was a little more involved with the government at the time, but the teachings of Sakya are also basically employing Lojong techniques, and they shared a lot of common text. And then the third one is the Gelugpa. Now, the Gelugpas really didn't form until about 200 years later, and even after their founder, who is called Tsongkhapa, who is actually a Kagyu, but because he emphasized conduct so much over everything else, that his followers, after his death, about 100 years after his death, actually put together what's called the Gelugpa school. So the Dalai Lama is a Gelugpa, and all the Dalai Lamas have been Gelugpas. Before the Dalai Lamas, the Sakyas were really running Tibet. And so it became, but in Tibet, the government, politics, and Dharma are utterly, inextricably intertwined. Mm. So we have the good fortune of only having to deal with Dharma. When you start thinking about politics in Tibet and listen to the various ways, the history and description of things, you're getting into politics. Just realize that. It's not Dharma, it's politics.
And they if we have to consider Trump, that's Dharma.
That's it. Exactly.
But also the unique quality of the situation in this country, particularly in our group, is that people come from many religious traditions.
That's right.
I think that's really quite amazing. It's very open in terms of the way we communicate and work together. Mm-hmm.
Can you put a few more words when you say lineage? Does that mean the people involved, or is it the teaching, or how do you define
the teaching? Lineage? Okay, so when we talk about lineage, we talk about transmission. Mm-hmm. And almost every school of Buddhism I know about or have studied, including Zen, has a sense of transmission, that there are people who embody the teachings, realize them, and convey or communicate the essence of these teachings in such a way that they're people who study with them, their students, actually get it and are actually maintaining this kind of thing without starting to edit and change it and add this and 10 of that, and the next thing we know we're in a completely different world. It's like there's a sense of purity and continuation with this lineage, and so it is through transmission. So we're looking at teachings that have been transmitted through various people over the last, particularly Tibetan Buddhism, which is where actually this flourished, because in India, Buddhism came to a screeching halt around 1200. It just basically had to go underground. It was just completely shut off. All of the Buddhist books, or most of them, were burnt, destroyed. The Buddhist monasteries were sacked or just simply shut away. Nalanda University, which was a famous learning center, was completely destroyed. And so Tibet was where these teachings actually were taken. They actually brought, they had this amazing capacity to go through this just amazing ability to translate Tibetan Sanskrit text into Tibetan and give it a life that wasn't just sort of half-baked kind of translation. They actually could recreate this. It was an extraordinary thing. It took place over about 500 years. So, you know, it's a really remarkable that Tibet could, because they can retranslate back into Sanskrit some of these things. That some of the Sanskrit texts that were lost entirely but translated to Tibetan later, after this whole Muslim domination stopped, and then the British came in and, of course, made things miserable, but they did lighten that up. And later, Sanskrit scholars started looking for these original sutras and couldn't find them, but if they went to the Tibetan, they could retranslate back into Sanskrit, and they actually they've actually been validated as being, you know, completely, they can go either way. They're so well translated. So that was amazing, kind of preservation of these teachings.
And it can go from English back to Tibet, because what I studied with Pama Gompishe, people said, your English is perfect, you don't need a translator, why do you have a translator? And he said, I want the teachings to also be given in Tibet so they can go back to Tibet. Mm. And I just melted my heart. I mean, he could have done the whole program in English, and he did it in both languages. Mm. So those teachings could go back to the origin. Isn't that incredible?
So if we become realized, we can someday go to Tibet and give it to them. So we should work on that.
But they were also preserved in Sri Lanka, in Bali. You know, the Buddhist teachings.
Yes.
Yes. And I just feel I need to speak up.
Good, say more.
I mean Sri Lanka.
You should
also.
Say more.
Huh?
Yeah. Say more.
Say more. So the Buddhist teachings were preserved
in Sri Lanka.
They were. Those teachings generally are early Buddhist teachings.
Excuse me?
They're early Buddhist teachings.
Yes.
And of course, they were preserved because Pali, Ceylon or Sri Lanka was not part of the Mughal Empire. They didn't have to endure all that. But at the same time, they were not necessarily partaking of the later development of Mahayana Buddhism.
No.
But
I'd say the first
beginning.
Right.
Yeah, and I think if not for this preservation in Sri Lanka, it might have just got wiped
out. Right. No, all the original sutras, the original sutras are all in Pali.
Right.
And they were translated into Sanskrit, as a matter of fact. Or they were co-translated because the Buddha didn't speak either Pali or Sanskrit. He actually spoke another language which was local to the part of Nepal where he came from. But because those early translations were all safely maintained in Sri Lanka, we know we have those, and that's one way of also checking against some of these later translations to see whether they were. So when we talk about this word transmission or lineage, we're talking about some sense of continuity and purity, and you realize they were not changed or modified. Mm-hmm. We see a continuity that's very reliable and steady. So we can understand how the Buddha taught and what he said, and how those words are still true today, and they haven't been altered. Very important. Yeah. Let's just talk a minute, because we're going to go into this whole thing about understanding what bodhisattva meditation is, quickly. This is going to be something that's introduced. We're talking about, we have about 5 minutes, so. I mentioned earlier that and this is something discussed by Trungpa Rinpoche in his second volume of The Profound Treasury, is that we actually, it's a deliberate compassion that we start with. We're actually manufacturing it, which is very important, rather than just assuming we either have it or don't. I mean, why can't I feel compassionate towards somebody I can't stand? You know, I mean, it's not like you're automatically going to shift into feeling compassionate for that person or for people or evils in the world. So we actually have to create this. We make it up. That's our first step. Because without that first stage, it's very hard to understand how basically we can reverse the flow of aggression. And aggression means if we reject something because we don't like it, that's also considered rejection, aggression. It's not like it's only other people who have this aggression problem. I don't really have any aggression, but meanwhile, I can't stand sitting next to this person, and I don't want to go over here, and I don't want to visit that person. I don't want to even speak to this person because they get me upset. You know, that's aggression, actually. We are rejecting. So we start to work with these meditation instructions, and we actually can use our breathing, just like we have with our shamatha practice, initial shamatha practice, to actually start practicing bodhisattva practice. And that's something called giving and taking, or sending and receiving, and we do it with our breathing. So that's considered manufactured because we actually take that on. We have these instructions. We say, okay, I'll do this, right? If we do that enough and we actually learn, embrace these teachings and actually explore them for far enough and employ the slogans, we can arrive at the second stage, which is not deliberate at all, but naturally responsive. It's a spontaneous response. And we actually learn about this term emptiness or shunyata at the same time, because we're practicing and learning how to open ourselves to this without a watcher being present. Does that make sense? There's no watcher.
You said something without...
A watcher.
Okay, watcher.
Somebody who's keeping track of all this, running it all down and, you know, keeping track of my chart, how am I doing, you know, I'm doing pretty good this week, last week was, you know, but this much better, you know, all this stuff, personal history.
I was thinking of the word train, and whatever it is that you're training in, it's not coming naturally, like at the beginning, mm-hmm. otherwise you don't need the training.
Yes.
And so it's, you know, like...
That's right. But in our case, as I mentioned, I think what we discover is when we actually reach to this point of non-deliberate compassion or natural responsiveness, we discover actually that's already present in us, that we actually have this natural responsiveness. It's fundamental to ourselves, but only when we get out of the way, because we've been in the way. Yeah.
I just want to point out an example about that. I remember after 9/11... in New York, that I had just left September 8th, so I was still in contact with a lot of people who were still directly dealing with that, and they would say, my brother went down there, other people, they would say that all of a sudden, because everything got kind of exploded, there was deepest kindness that people were extending to each other.
Mm-hmm.
It was almost as if everyone down there was wrapped up in love for each other. It didn't, I mean, it, you know, it stopped after a while, but...
No, but this,
you know,
in emergencies like this, suddenly people do things that are you know, you would never attribute these capacities to people to be able to go great bravery, willingness to go to any kind of length to help somebody out at the cost of their own life often.
Yes.
Just do it. Just spontaneously do it. Nobody's sitting around thinking about merit. They're just doing it. So that helps us understand something about, you know, something more in terms of our core nature, our essence nature, which is what we're actually getting at. We're learning about essence. We're learning about mind essence, which is basically this, when we talk about the empty nature. And that's fundamentally Buddha nature. So our Buddha nature is right in us, alive and well. You know, it's not something that needs to be taken care of. It doesn't need any care at all. It's perfectly good already. And I would like to leave you with that thought while we continue exploring this path of Lojong.